Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This Labor Day, we take a look at writing labor history with Steve Watkins, author of The Mine Wars, The Bloody Fight for Workers' Rights in the West Virginia Coalfields. Watkins is joined by labor historian Rosemary Foyer. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the last program of the day here on the History and Biography stage at the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am an education program coordinator at the American Writers Museum, where we celebrate the past, promote the present, and inspire the future of American writing. A critical part of what we do at the museum is communicate history to young people, which is the subject of our next program. How do we take well-known yet controversial events and make them clear and crucial for younger audiences? In The Mine Wars, author Steve Watkins tells the true story of America's largest labor uprising in a graphic nonfiction book that follows West Virginia coal miners in their quest for fair wages and safety in dangerous jobs. Steve is an award-winning author of 12 books for young readers, including Down Sand Mountain, which won the 2009 Golden Kite Award for Young Adult Fiction. He also writes books for grown-ups and won a Pushcart Prize for one of the stories in his collection, My Chaos Theory. He'll be interviewed today by Rosemary Foyer, a labor historian and scholar of the Illinois mining conflicts and associate professor of history at Northern Illinois University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. I am also the project director for the Mother Jones Heritage Project, and Mother Jones is one of the featured characters in this book, and I think it's one of the reasons that I was asked to have a conversation with Steve. Mother Jones was the most famous labor organizer a century ago. She's buried in Illinois, and our project is seeking and is, I think, going to be successful in getting a statue to her memory. And really that memory is more than about just her, because the name of the statue is We Shall Rise, and it's about putting the people's history in the public sphere. So one of the, she's one of the main characters. She organized, she came from Chicago, but she organized in the coal fields across the country. Energy workers were key to struggle, and to, they were, she thought they were key to making workers powerful. Across the globe, it's energy workers and transportation workers who have the ability to really shut down the industry in order to make claims for a better life. And so it's one of the reasons that she was there. Steve's book, The Mine Wars, and the subtitle is The Bloody Fight, and I think when you read this, you'll see that it is a very bloody episode, one of the most violent series of episodes in U.S. labor history. This book, you know, I've read every book on the West Virginia Mine Wars that's out there, and, you know, for adults, there's nothing for children besides your book, as far as I know. And it is so compelling. I was riveted, really, by the description and the narrative and the way that he framed it. So I'm really delighted to be here with you to talk about the book. The main thing that I think is so interesting is in the end of the book, where you describe how much this history has been hidden. And I thought we could start with that, you know, explaining why it was hidden, why it hasn't been in the public sphere of West Virginia or really in the nation's history, and why it should be.
Great question, and a very important one, because I think it speaks to the way history informs us and the way history or versions of history are sanctioned or not, and the importance of questioning all of that. As you know, in fact, a great deal has been written about the West Virginia coal mine wars, and I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to the researchers who dealt with primary sources, oral histories, you know, important historical accounts of what went on in the West Virginia coal mine wars. These were often works for some somewhat popular, but small publishers or academic works. It's been gaining notice as we've gone along. But what very deliberately happened from the 1920s on, after the West Virginia Coal Mine Wars, the events that I write about in the Mine Wars, is that those who controlled the politics, the courts, you know, law enforcement, education in West Virginia, made sure that the story of coal mining in West Virginia elided the United Mine Workers of America and their organizing activities. They just wrote it out of history. And they did this by having their own guy, an educator, write the history book that was used for decades in public schools in West Virginia. And so what happens is, you know, this is way before social media, way before we have, you know, means of telling stories that we do now, but generations of West Virginians didn't even know this happened. And what's been really interesting in the more recent years, as people have read some of the, you know, the other accounts, John Green's is the most important, but mine as well, and I think I'm contributing to that that effort to get the history that has been buried out to a broader reading audience. And you know, we're fighting decades of elision, decades of buried history, literally buried history, because, you know, who controlled West Virginia is who controls West Virginia still today, even though coal mining is tanking, you know, faster than we can describe it. But these are the coal mine owners. These are, you know, the mining industry, right? And so they've gotten to tell the story. And now I think it's a very, very important thing for young West Virginians who are growing up in a most impoverished, you know, area, you know, arguably in the country, to be able to reclaim what is and should have always been a very, very proud history of, you know, in the extraction industries, you know, of courage, of union activity that brought people together from all races and ethnicities in ways that is the most fundamental or should be American story, and yet has been denied all these years.
So tell me, or tell the audience, about some of the drama and some of the issues involved. There are, you know, real villains in this story. There are some heroes, with not heroes without flaws, but all of them collide in an escalating battle that results in what's called the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. So can you just give a little capsule summary of some of those characters and the story?
Well, of course, nothing happens in a vacuum. And if you know the history of, and this happened a lot of other places too, West Virginia is a particular, you know, manifestation of it. You have a history of repression and of control by mine owners. And it was pretty easy for them to do in rural West Virginia, where often the only way in or out of these mining camps, where mine workers, you know, worked living in company housing, you know, only getting paid in scrip, which was company money, essentially, only being able to buy things at the company store and so forth. But there was no way in or out. Most of the people had no form of transportation except the trains. And, oh yeah, the railroad companies owned most of the coal mines. And so the levels of control of the people who lived and worked these industries that built America, or built modern America, modern, you know, industrial America, you know, were denied what they considered, or what we all considered, inalienable American rights to, you know, for free association and so forth.
Yeah, in fact, when Mother Jones was organizing in West Virginia, she sought out what she called a free town. The rest of them were unfree, you know, that they were so controlled, and that was Mate One.
She called Southern West Virginia, she called all of West Virginia medieval West Virginia, and for very good reason, because in this repressive, you know, environment, anyone who bucked the system either lost their job right away, And if you lost your job, it wasn't like you went to the next mine to get a job. You were blackballed. You had nothing. And these were people living, I mean, hard, hard existences in their families. And but here is this fundamental American story. People resisted. And they paid, many of them, the harshest price, beatings, murders, poverty, certainly, deprivation. They were kicked out of their company-owned homes. But little by little, they sought to make common cause. One of the first people who came in to do coal mining in West Virginia was one of these villains, and his name is Justice Collins. It is spelled J-U-S-T-U-S, Just Us Collins.
One of the villains.
One of the many villains in this story. He had this, what he thought was this brilliant scheme, and he convinced other coal operators and owners to embrace it. He called it judicious mixture. The judicious mixture of Justice Collins was this. Take some rural West Virginian mountain folk. Take some, descendants of slaves from the deeper south. Go to Eastern Europe and bring in some people who don't even speak English. Put them in a coal camp or a coal town, segregated, and they will never be able to make common cause with one another. They'll be at odds with one another, their bigotry, their prejudice, their language barriers, their enmity, their racism will keep them apart. It blew up in his face, because what happened was these people came together. For one thing, when you're underground and you're covered head to toe in coal dust, nobody cares what your ethnicity is, what your race is, probably can't even tell, but they realized they were all oppressed equally. And so the United Mine Workers of America, in their constitution said there will be no, we won't make any discrimination, based on, ethnicity or race. They came together, and this was one of the strengths, one of the most important things about, the development, of the United Mine Workers Association and the union activities. But it was not without great cost. My story begins on a day in 1920, in May, when coal mine owners hired the Baldwin-Felts Detective Agency. They weren't detectives in the sense that you might think of it. They were basically thugs. Goons, spies, who would come in and bust up union activities. And bust up often meant, physical violence or even disappearing people. In the free town of Matewan, in the mines around there, there had been union activities before, and some of the mines elsewhere in West Virginia had been unionized, but not in southern West Virginia. But, they decided, they weren't even on strike, they just signed union cards. And by signing union cards, a great many of these people and their families were thrown out of their homes. And it went on and it went on, and people were living in union-supplied tent camps. The police chief of Matewan and the mayor were actually sympathetic to the miners and had been miners themselves, and decided they'd had enough. And so one day, some of these gun thugs show up, Baldwin-Felts detectives, throw a bunch of people out of their homes. They're going back to get on the train. And these people had had enough. And Cobble Testerman, who was the mayor, and Sid Hatfield, not related to the Hatfields of Hatfield and McCoy notoriety, confronted them as on their way to the train station to go back to union headquarters and said, "Where's your papers to allow you to do this?" There was some back and forth on that. No one exactly knows who fired the first shot, but they do know that there were dozens of armed union men out of work, stationed around the train station, that Sid Hatfield was known as Two Gun Sid because he always carried a heavy. But when the shooting ended, seven of the Baldwin-Felts agents were dead. Some of them chased down in the street and shot in the head because these people had had enough. Whether you justify that level of violence or not, you have to understand the context for it. Three on the miner side were killed, including Cobble Testerman. And that set off this chain of events that roiled, southern West Virginia and led about a year and a half later to what became the largest armed insurrection in American history since the Civil War. Mm-hmm. and that was the Battle of Blair Mountain, where at least 10,000 armed miners, you know, determined after months and months and months of repression, of martial law, of the owners and their minions busting up printing presses for socialist or, you know, progressive newspapers, that they'd had enough. And they were going to go through, you know, the gates of hell, but the redoubt of Logan County, West Virginia, which was the most notorious and brutally repressive, you know, county, you know, in the state. And they were going to go over Blair Mountain. They were going to attack Logan County. They were going to hang the sheriff. They even had a song about it. And then they were going to keep going down, you know, into Mingo County, where dozens, if not hundreds, of their fellow miners had been, you know, arrested under martial law, no charges filed, just, you know, incarcerated. They were going to free them. They'd had it. And those were the events that I write about in the book, and I'll pause there because I'm going to let you ask another question.
Well, that's some of the drama. That's actually just a fraction of the drama. We have Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, which are another series of wars that happen as a prelude to this, 1912 to 1913, where organizers, including Mother Jones, were put in jail as conspirators to murder. Just this kind of trumped-up legal system. So can you talk about how you explain that to young readers? And also, now since you've called up the violence, how did you struggle with explaining this level of violence to that target audience?
Well, the bloodier the better, I say. No. Well, it didn't start with the Matewan Massacre, or that's actually what the owners called it. Yeah. They called it, you know,
The Battle of Matewan.
They didn't see it as a massacre, the miners and their supporters. Oh, yeah, 10 years before, you know, in the aftermath of horrific violence against the miners, but also safety conditions. I mean, there were mine explosions and collapses that killed hundreds and hundreds, and they don't even know how many, because in so many cases, young boys would go into the mines with their fathers, and it wasn't exclusively, you know, male job, but they weren't counted. But what the work they did to help their fathers went into, you got paid, you know, by the amount of coal that you mined, and so the work that they did with, so they weren't officially even there. And so, you know, when the Monongah, you know, mine disaster happened, for example, in 1907, you know, officially it was 300 and something, you know, who died in actually two mine explosions. But everybody knew it was probably more like 600 or more, many of them children. In fact, the owners tried to blame this mythical child who must have, you know, struck a match where he shouldn't have, this kind of craziness. But, you know, in the teens, you know, that was when the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike happened, and where a lot of the activism really got going. But there, too, there was a significant amount of violence. You know, the miners were not, they were not Gandhi. You know, they were not going to effect change. They were not going to unionize without fighting, frankly, fire with fire. And they knew that because they had seen over and over and over again what happened to union organizers who were beaten, who were threatened, who were, in some cases, killed just outright or just disappeared into the hollers and so forth. So they knew what it was going to take. I'm not a gun guy. You know, I'm right there with, you know, let's put the brakes on, you know, gun ownership and, you know, these high capacity magazines and stuff. But this was the world. This was the world that they were in, and they weren't always nice about it. Sid Hatfield was not a good guy. He was on the right side of the union, you know, effort as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, no one made a big case that he was some saint. And so I think one of the things that I want and would hope that young readers would get out of this is you don't have to be perfect or a saint to be on the right side of justice. It's BS. We know it is. And yet we still play to those myths. And the same thing with things like, you know, union organizing and union activity. And you know this way more than I do because this is your area and I'm just a dilettante stepping into your turf. So I appreciate you sharing it with me. But, I think it's important that young people know that there was violence and there was a part of this. But I tried to write this in such a way that, I don't want to endorse it, but I don't want to deny that it was a part of the story.
But I think what you do brilliantly in the book is show that, the legal system was so tied up, entwined with these private interests, these private police, that the private policing and the public policing went hand in hand, even in that march, that it isn't like the Baldwin-Felts agents were this private group hired by the West Virginia coal operators and capital finance from New York, from J.P. Morgan. This is what they were doing. I mean, the one part of it that is just astonishing that you played up is that the sheriff, who's supposed to be a public official, do you want to tell that? Don Chafin.
Don Chafin, yeah. He's another one of
the... was paid $50,000 a year by the coal operators, by capitalists, in addition to his $2,000 a year public salary, right? So this is power. That's raw power. I don't know if you told what that would be in today's dollars, but here's a West Virginia official being paid by the coal operators. So it's that has to make any student or young person reading this pause to think about how power is shaped.
And I think that's a very, very important part of the story. Again, getting back to the nothing happens in a vacuum, that it wasn't just the coal owners versus, the workers. It wasn't as simple as that. For one thing, most of the coal owners didn't even live there. You had operators who were, doing it for these robber barons, in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and New York and London. And most of the money being made wasn't even staying in the state. That trickle-down nonsense, that wasn't happening then either. It was going elsewhere. It wasn't staying in West Virginia. But you had in so many of these counties, there were exceptions, but they were few, so many of these counties where the coal mine owners, they own the politicians. They were the politicians in many cases. They owned the courts. They literally owned, paid the salary, under the table salary of Sheriff Don Chafin, and his deputies, essentially an army, that he controlled, in Logan County. And then this happened other places in West Virginia as well. Well, if you're a miner, who do you look to for redress? Who's going to support you? It's going to be other miners. It's going to be the mine workers union. But who else? Where are you going to go? Because if you respond as they did with some level of violence, then state police come in and the governor declares martial law and this judge it's a military judge by that point, orders everybody who congregates, two people congregate who are union or are seen holding a union leaflet, you get arrested under martial law. And then they go into these, as I said before, there were some socialist newspapers and some other progressive newspapers that were supportive of the miners. They would shut them down. They would bust up their printing presses. So where do you go? Well, you pick up that hunting rifle. Or what happened more and more to a great many of these, you had served your country, as thousands, tens of thousands of these workers had done in the Great War, what was known as the Great War at that time. Well, you still have your uniform. You still have, in many cases, your weapon, or you bought it on surplus. And so increasingly, you go to those weapons, and when it came time for the Battle of Blair Mountain, these guys put on their old army uniforms, a great many of them. They called them the Redneck Army because they were rednecks. I guess a lot of them were. But they tied a red bandana around their necks so they could,
identify
one another. But they saw themselves as proud Americans who were being denied their American rights to organize, to free associate, for freedom of speech, on and on and on. And, they saw themselves as being victimized. They didn't want to be victims. They wanted to just do a day's labor and get paid, and be able to make their decisions for themselves. So that's Mm-hmm. That's what they're up against.
And they just saw that private army as illegitimate, and it was their right to take on that private army, but maybe not so much the federal troops, right? There was a sense that these are hired thugs, and it's our right to fight fire with fire.
Well, the Battle of Blair Mountain went on for several days, and it was a pitched battle. There were machine guns. There were planes dropping bombs on the miners. They were inept as could be and didn't hit anybody, but they sure tried. The fabled Billy Mitchell, if you know much about your World War One history, you know he was going to fly in, and he ended up doing nothing. But this was a pitched battle, and of course, Don Chaffin's army, private army, and the owners had the high ground. You know, well, you know what that means. They had days knowing the miners were marching slowly, you know, to Blair Mountain, and so they were defending the high ground. The miners were trying to, you know, attack up the hill. There were, you know, back and forth it went. No one knows how many, frankly, were killed, because the miners would take the bodies of the dead miners and spirit them away, and they'd be buried in family graves, and no one really ever knew. It could have been in the hundreds. I've seen different numbers. But they likely would have prevailed. They had the numbers. They definitely had the dedication. And, oh, yeah, the guy that Don Chaffin had chosen to run his private army was drunk the whole time. And, back in the town of Logan. But then Warren Harding, the president, finally was convinced by the West Virginia governor to call in federal troops, which he did. And the minute the federal troops came in, the miners stood down, because they were not going to fight their own people. And they saw the federal troops as their own people. They had served in that same army. These were American soldiers. These weren't West Virginia, mine thugs or their minions or people on their payroll. These were other fellow Americans wearing the uniform. They respected them. They were not going to fight them. And they saw, and we were talking about this just before, probably in some ways naively, that this in some ways could be their salvation, that surely now that the U.S. government was involved, not just, you know, these West Virginia, bondsold West Virginians, that someone would see the situation for what it was, that they were being treated unfairly, that their lives were in jeopardy every time they went down in these unsafe mines, that their children, you know, didn't have proper education, on and on and on and on, that they weren't getting paid, you know, properly, you know, they're being paid in script, and on and on and on, that martial law was denying them their American rights, that once the troops came in, the federal troops would see, they and their officers, what was really going on in West Virginia, and they would make it stop. And they would restore the rights to these workers, their right to unionize, to organize. Instead, what happened was, after they stood down, a lot of them gave up their weapons, a lot of them didn't. They were arrested en masse. And at 500 or more, well, actually, the West Virginia governor tried to get Warren Harding to bring the miners up on federal charges of treason. And Harding, it was no great shakes for anybody, but he didn't want to have anything to do with it, didn't see it as politically viable. He washed his hands and said, no, if you want to bring him up on treason, that's your state thing, which is what they did. So they went to the Jefferson County Courthouse, where, fellow you may remember, John Brown was convicted of treason and subsequently hung. And they tried, or these 500 miners and organizers and officials, there, or at least they tried to. They got one conviction out of it, because I think regular West Virginians in that area, you weren't going to convict anybody of doo-doo. Plus, the charges just didn't add up. You know, what exactly did you do? What exactly did I do? I wasn't attacking the state. You know, that's the definition of treason. And so a lot on the, you know, charge of treason, it never came to fruition. But what it did do, which was most damaging, was it bankrupted the union, District 17 of the union. And so it put the kibosh on union organizing in southern West Virginia for probably 15 years, wrecked lives, squelched any union movement, mm-hmm. until Roosevelt came into office.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that you do is bring up the Red Scare that's happening around this time. So I think that's another valuable thing is to show how these mountaineers, you know, were, as well as African Americans, they were all labeled as a bunch of communists led by, or dumb miners led by communists in this time.
Yeah, the first Red Scare, you of course know about McCarthy era, but the Red Scare in the, you know, in the 20s, you know, after World War II, you know, was in some ways even worse because there were murders and there were mob, you know, lynchings, you know, of suspected socialists and communists and the Wobblies and public opinion around America, you know, of the West Virginians was largely twofold. One is they're a bunch of dumb hicks that have, the Hatfields and McCoys, you know, have their dumb mountain feuds, you know, they're a bunch of drunks, toothless, you know, that kind of picture. And then the other was that they're being led by the nose by these communists, they're socialists, they're anti-American. And it's kind of like, take your pick. And I quote, after the assassination, the murder of Sid Hatfield, which is a whole other story in this book, quote a New York Times editorial where they the headline is Primitive Ferocities, where they just mock, you know, it's a very serious story that I'm telling you about. They're just mocking it. It's just a joke. It's like a old Lil Abner cartoon to the New York Times in what they wrote. It's really one of the more disturbing things of a very, very disturbing story.
Right. You know, so what I appreciate about this is that it is bringing this to young people. Do you think this book has a chance of getting play in West Virginia? I mean, I know that that's obviously one of the places. I would say it's a national story, and it really shows so many of the themes of labor history. You know, first of all, that there was a lot of conflict. I mean, one of the things that labor historians have done across the years is try to show this is a myth about American history, right? That there was no conflict. It's full of conflict on the job. You know, with the rise of child labor today, here's a story where you encounter children working in the mines and children as activists. One of the things Mother Jones loved to do is figure out a way to make children into activists. She would have the young miners learn math, she said, so that she could teach them how much they were exploited. You know, so you need to be able to add up how much they're selling the coal versus what you're getting for it, right? Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about that, these experiences, that it make it a national story as well as a West Virginia story?
Well, first off, I think you and I will be in full agreement that what this country needs, number one, is a biopic of the life of Mother Jones. Mary Harris Jones. It is way past time. I'm sure there's been some crap out there, but we need some serious money to go into that biopic, and we need the statue of Mother Jones that you have been working on for years to come up soon in Chicago, the greatest labor city in America, if I might say. So we need those two things to happen. Third thing that needs to happen is the school board of West Virginia, whatever they call it, needs to adopt this book. And it needs to be a supplemental text in every middle school class, history classroom in the great state of West Virginia. And I say that obviously, you know, because I want to sell a lot of books and make a lot of money. But because I keep going back to the thing we've been talking about, which is if you believe in America, in the promise of America, if you believe in the promise of America, there is so much about the story of the miners and their families and their children and their wives that speaks to the promise of America and what we can be and what we should be. So it, in that way, it's a very much a West Virginia history story, but it's also a story that should inspire all of us by what these people coming together, that judicious mixture, you know, almost accomplished and ultimately sort of kind of did, and that we can too, and without that, we can't. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.